In today's episode of A Lighter Note, Mr. Andile Khumalo, the group chairman of Brave Group, is in discussion with Ian Furr, the founder of the Sorbet Group and the Hatch Institute. In this discussion, Ian is sharing with Andile his 40 plus years of experience of mastering culture and obsessive customer service. Furr packs his lessons, insights, and best practices into the culture guide that you ever need. Get yourself a copy, and we hope you enjoy this episode of the next Brave Conversation.
Good evening, ladies and gents. My name is Andile Khumalo. My claim to fame is to be Ian Furr's friend. I met Ian Furr after he had just written his first book, Get That Feeling, only because my wife loved sorbet. And I came across the book when I was doing a business show in my previous life at Power FM. And I read this book and I thought, what an amazing story. Especially the part about Whitney Houston. And I reached out to him and through your daughter, is it Jade? Yeah, she was writing the marketing at the time, I think. And the producer got hold of Ian and we got on air, and I'm not making this up, but a real friendship grew as a result of that. And after many times of interacting further on I'm an Entrepreneur, etc., and he very kindly asked me to host the session. He didn't tell me that I'd be on the cover of the book. I mean, I feel sorry for everyone else that's at the back of the book. They just seem more accomplished than I.
You deserve to be on the cover of the book.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you. So this evening, we've got a very simple program. I'm going to let Ian say a few words also just to open up. But in terms of the program, to manage your expectations, we're going to have a little chat here for about 30 minutes about the book. I don't want to reveal all the secrets of the book. That's very difficult in my job not to do, because I've obviously read the book and I'm excited about talking about it. Because I really want you to buy one and then tell everybody else about it. And then for about 15 minutes, we're going to open the floor if you guys have any questions. Ian, would you like to say a few words maybe to the guests?
Hi, everybody, and thank you so much for being with us tonight. Much appreciated. And thank you very much for agreeing to host this. I appreciate it, my good friend. And I look forward to your questions. I have no idea what's coming, but I'm going to give it my best shot.
He said to me when we were preparing for the session, he said, if I don't have an answer for any of your questions, I'm going to make up the answer on the spot. So perhaps we should all look out. Ian, let's start at, a lot about in the book is already about your journey. And for most of us who know your journey of kind of back in the day with Kmart, which became a very interesting brand story as well, to building a business through the most difficult times of our country, yes. Especially the 70s, the mid-70s, and all the way to you lying somewhere, getting a massage and coming up with the idea of sorbet, you know, all the way to selling it. And
let's not get too deep into that.
I'm trying to remove the image in my head, I promise. And to you building the Hatch Institute, what made you write this book? Because it's a sensitive book.
It's a sensitive book. Okay, so I think if you look back at my history as an entrepreneur, I've always been fascinated by people and culture, race relations, and leadership and things like that. So it's always been about the people side of business.
Yeah,
I've never been mad about all the other stuff, operations and finance. So I developed over the years through my various entrepreneurial ventures, I developed like a framework for a culture, for a business culture that I believed could lay the platform for really good customer service. And that was always the issue, was the link between culture and service. And that really was what the thing that, you know, that actually sort of attracted me, fascinated me, and I learned about it. And of course, if you look back at the history, all the race relations issues also became a big part of my life. I learned about that in my early days when I was the only white person in a business in Johannesburg called Kmart, running that business. All the staff were black, all the customers were black, and so that was a big sort of baptism of fire for me, and I was a little bit overwhelmed, but at the time, you know, I decided that if I didn't understand the people that I was working with, I would never be able to manage them or lead them effectively. So I got myself a mentor, and he took me into Soweto at the time, 1976, just after the uprisings, believe it or not. And he taught me all about the other side of the country that I'd never seen. I'd grown up as a young Jewish boy, very isolated, very privileged, just not knowing anything about what was going on with the other race groups. And yeah, so that's how I started learning. And the more I saw, the more I got involved, the more passionate I became about social justice and, you know, and systemic racism and all the impact that it was having on people throughout the country and certainly on the people that were working with me at the time. So that's where the passion started. And then over the years, I developed it more and more and more through the music business and then through my race relations consulting business in the 90s until I ended up on the massage table.
So post the massage table, which we're all trying to make sure, in our minds, you are fully dressed. We are not concerned about how you may or may not look. Post the massage table, building a wonderful business, eventually selling it. You then start a new business, Hatch Institute, and you come up with this model, which is what the book is mainly based about. Can you take us through the what you call the culture-neering monument, especially in the context of South Africa? Because, you know, when the world talks of diversity here, there's the rest of the world diversity and then there's South Africa diversity.
Yes.
Because, you know, we do things in a special way.
In a very special way,
Talk to us about that monument, that model, and specifically in how it applies maybe to business leaders in South Africa in particular.
Okay, right. So the culture-neering model, or in fact the definition of culture-neering, is the art of building a strong culture, right, in a diverse workforce that lays the platform for obsessive customer service. That's the definition. So the model itself, the framework, it starts off with the socio-political environment in the soil, as it were. So the socio-political environment means that we need to understand what's happening outside of the business in the rest of the country and the impact that has on the people in the business and the culture. So you can't ignore that stuff. You know, we've got huge challenges in this country, particularly with race relations. I've always been pretty confident that racial polarization is the biggest challenge that we face in South Africa. And if we can't handle that, we're never going to be able to come right. So we focus a lot on that, on the socio-political environment and how it impacts on people in the workplace. So we need to understand it. We need to address it. We cannot ignore it.
But some people may say, you know, when you come to work, Mr. Khumalo, you must leave your problems there at the door, Chief. You are not here to deal with your personal issues. You are here to work. Ian is telling me I must understand the socio-political context. I don't really want to understand the socio-political context.
Leaving your things at the door reminds me of the old OK bazaars. They used to have a thing called a parcel counter there.
Yeah.
And you used to come in and you used to leave your bags.
Yeah. Right?
You put your bag there and they give you a little disc.
Yeah.
And now we expect people to come into the workplace and leave all their problems and their thoughts at the door and then pick them up on the way out.
On the way out?
Yes, no, because we don't want to talk about politics here. We don't want to talk about race and religion and ish.
So why must I understand the socio-political context in relation to me leading a group, a team of people?
Okay. So if we want to build a strong culture, we need to understand that every single person there needs to have a sense of belonging.
Right.
Okay. A sense of belonging in that they feel accepted and respected and trusted, that they feel that they are treated with fairness and dignity and equality, that their contributions are valued. Right? So if we can achieve that, then we can have a situation where we can start to create a common purpose, where everybody comes to work for the same reason and everyone is accepted and respected for who they are despite their differences. So if we don't address that and we have issues and we have a toxic culture where people don't respect each other, where there's no tolerance for each other, there's a lot of discontent and unhappy people because they don't understand each other, they're upsetting each other, there's tension, then the first people to suffer there are always the customers. Okay? So the customer experience will never be better than the staff experience.
Okay. The customer experience will never be better than the staff experience.
If the staff are unhappy, the customers are also going to be unhappy because there won't be any focus on the customers. There's only focus on the issues and the problems internally. So there's a focus inwards rather than outwards. And that's why we need to address the socio-political.
Is that why also when you talk about that common purpose, I think you call it for reason for being or reason to being.
Right, the reason for being, which is the purpose of the organization.
Right.
Why does it exist?
But you also raise a good point in the book about, and I think it's worth going through, about the fact that when you come up with that, right? Because, yeah. I mean, we've heard the story before. Mission, yeah. Vision, yeah. Values, all that stuff.
Yes.
Well, you talk about purpose, and you say it has to be about the customer.
Absolutely.
Very often, I've read many missions and visions. Very, very often, they're not about the customer. They're all about how we're going to be number one, and we're going to be the best what, or the number one what. No one ever says, I'm going to be the customer's favorite person.
No. So that's the problem. Okay, so the problem is that we focus on making money generally. Now, we go into business with the idea of making money, but we have to understand that we first have to serve the customer. So service must always come first before reward.
Wait.
Service comes before reward. So we don't go to work to make money. I know that sounds a bit odd.
A bit. Most people in the room, if you had to ask them, why do you go to work? Why do you start a business? It's to make money. What are you trying to say?
Now, the problem is that if you go to work to make money, you aren't going to focus sufficiently on service, okay? Because you're just going to look at what you can get out of the business rather than what you can put into it.
Right.
Okay, so you start to take more than you give. And it's all about how can I get more and more out. And in terms of profits, I'm looking at how I can save money here, and I can cut costs there, and I can take a few shortcuts here. And of course, the customer is always the one who suffers as a result of that. Mm. But if we focus on the customer, the money will always follow. That's the trick.
Focus on the customer.
Focus on the customer. Serve them to the very best of your ability, and the money will follow. But if we focus on the money, it doesn't mean the customer's going to win.
All right. Okay. So you've got social political context at the bottom.
Yeah.
And right at the top, you've got obsessive customer service, which you've touched on.
Yes.
Underpinning that is the culture of the common person, which is the reason to being. Correct. And then you've got these three pillars. Talk me through the first one, which is self-development.
Okay. Self-development is really important in terms of leadership. Now, these days, you know, we can't ask leaders to go out there and to transform businesses and cultures and to change people if they haven't yet demonstrated the ability to change themselves. So we get people to look at themselves and they go on a journey of self-discovery, understanding their own paradigms and their own prejudices and biases and beliefs and all the things that have created them and what they are today. So you need to understand who you are, what your biases are, how you got them. Did it come from your parental upbringing? Did it come from your social conditioning? Did it come from your life experiences? Did it come from your relationships with people? All of those things have created what you are today. And so if you understand that, you'll be able to identify the things that are blocking you, blocking your way forward. Your fears, your self-doubt, your low self-confidence, your shame, your guilt, all of the things, I call them blockers, okay? And that self-development is understanding your blockers and being able to overcome them. That's the first part. So you cannot go out and lead people if you cannot demonstrate your own ability to change. You know, I saw quite a nice little saying the other day. It said, yesterday I thought I was clever, so I tried to change other people. But today, I became wise, so I tried to change myself.
Wow. Okay, so these paradigms are not the easiest things for leaders to accept.
Yeah.
In fact, if anything, most leaders do all they can to avoid, number one, just acknowledging that they've got these blockers.
Yes.
And number two, to addressing them, right? And which takes me to the next question I have for you about this concept of the moral authority to lead.
Okay. So we call that culture-driven leadership, okay, which is very different to the old traditional sort of power-based or power-driven leadership. So in the old days, if you were the boss, you had the power. You sat high up in the structures, high up in the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And you had the power over people. You could actually determine their lives, and you could tell them when they can get their next promotion and their next salary. So in fact, most people are focused on looking after the boss rather than the customer. You know, they always, you kind of see people that are sort of bowing down and groveling before the boss.
Well, that's the guy who pays my salary and determines my bonus.
Exactly, because you want to make the boss happy, And the customer's looking at your backside because you've turned your back on him, and he's looking at your back.
Because I'm busy bowing
at the boss, yeah.
Okay.
So we need to turn that around and say that we need to look at culture-driven leadership, which is to earn the moral authority to lead. So it's not, you know, the authority doesn't come from your power and from the position and the structure.
Mm.
Okay, that is not going to get people to respect you and look after you and do the things and trust you, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to earn that right. Okay, you have to earn it.
How do I earn that right?
Okay. So you have to first understand that people must respect and trust you. Okay. All right, that's the first thing. You have to earn that respect and trust. All right? The second thing is you have to show everybody that you are genuinely concerned about their well-being as people, not just as employees.
But should I be? This is work, Ian.
No.
It's not a...
No. It's not just... No,
it's a real question. At what
point... So these are people.
Yeah, but at what point do I draw the line? Should I be drawing the line? Because, you know, I work with you. We're not mates. And at what point do I say, okay, I've had enough interest in this particular employee or what person that works for me. But now it feels like, you know, this relationship is deeper than just kind of boss and employee.
It is, right? It becomes deeper because at the end of the day, you know, if you don't trust and respect your boss, okay, how much are you going to commit yourself to serving?
Mm.
Okay, to serving customers.
Mm.
You know, if you feel afraid and intimidated by your boss, how are you going to go out there and, you know, and give customer service a good shot? It's not going to happen. So you have to have that, you know, you have to earn that trust and respect. You have to show people that you have a genuine commitment and concern for their well-being, because at the moment, especially with COVID and all the things that have been happening here, you know, you have a situation where you have to check on people's health, their physical health, their psychological health, and their financial health, and see that they're okay, especially they've been working on their own, and there's a lot of health issues, mental health issues that we have to address. So people need to know that you are genuinely concerned about them as humans. The other thing is you have to show a true commitment to their training and development. That it's, you know, it's not just about training people for the company's benefit, it's about training people for their benefit. You know the old famous saying by Richard Branson, he said, you should train people to be able to leave you.
Wow.
Okay, but you should treat them in such a way so that they don't.
Mm. Ladies and gentlemen, so, I will refer you, when you do get the book for yourself, on page 52, they've got this wonderful questionnaire on this particular pillar of self-discovery. And I took it. And when you take it and you start ticking the boxes willy-nilly and you get to the end, and then tell you what your score means. It is a way of making you do some introspection. But I'll give you a bit of a sneak peek. On question one says, have you or do you ever make judgments about people based on the group from which they come? In other words, do you have any biases or prejudices about people who come from a different group to yours? And there's a couple of options. Option one, and of course, it says yes, no, so you pick the right box for you at least. Race, culture, religion, politics, gender, age, sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Ian goes on to say that all of us have got those prejudices. And if you scored, if you said, no, I got none of those, like, I love everybody. Every religion is great. Whatever your social orientation, high five, all of you. He's like, you're lying to yourself. So I found that very interesting.
Absolutely. Those answers all have to be yes.
Wow.
Because bias is a human condition.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a choice. It's a preference that we have. And it's just what you do with your bias that's important. You know, people answer no because they say, if I say no, people will think I'm a racist and that's bad.
Yep.
Okay, that must be bad. So I'll say no. Okay.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, it's yes, because we do have bias. And it's what we do with our bias that's important.
What should we do with our bias? Because
we must recognize
it is a guilt feel, right?
Like, correct, yeah.
However you feel, whatever it is that you feel about race, there's an element of you that you feel bad about it.
Sure. So we have to recognize the bias first.
Right.
And we also need to understand where it comes from. Because sometimes the unconscious bias actually catches us out. And I can tell you about that, you know. I worked in race relations for many, many years, and I'm still doing it now. And about 25 years ago, you know, if you had said to me that I was a racist, I would have really been angry. I would have given you a good clap. And right. There. There's no way.
No, not me.
Not me. Not this boy.
Other Oaks.
Other Oaks, maybe. Not me. So I was sitting on a plane waiting to take off to go to Cape Town. And the pilot comes off, you know, on the speaker system. Yeah. And he tells us this. And I recognize straight away that it's a black guy.
Yeah.
Because I can hear the accent. And I say, oh, shit. How are we going to get to Cape Town? I mean, can this actually fly this thing?
What is wrong with you, man?
I know that. It was very embarrassing. It was very embarrassing, but it was a massive wake-up call for me because that was something that was built into my psyche.
Yeah.
My psyche and my growing up and all of the things that happened in my life led me to believe that black people should be cleaning the plane, not flying it.
What makes you even write about this stuff? Don't you feel like a little bit of a imposter syndrome going, I'm a white guy writing about my own issues about race? I mean,
yeah, no.
How do you process it all? Your poor wife, where is she? I met her tonight. Shame on you. I'm sorry. What's wrong with this guy? He could just live happily ever after, run his business, and pretend like race doesn't exist.
Yeah, look, it's a big part of my life, and I'm very passionate about it, and I feel that we, as white people, need to acknowledge our privilege, and we need to do something about it, about this redressing of our past. And so some of the things that we do in the book, you know, is to highlight the history, South African history,
yes,
and the extent of the racial injustice there, because a lot of people don't know the detail, actually. When you go through it and you see some of the things that happened there, it's hard to believe that we had a system, a legalized system, which was so incredibly unfair. And just for example, you know that black people were never South African citizens. I mean, you would know, but a lot of people don't know that. So the whole idea of apartheid was to remove blacks from South Africa, essentially. So they divided the country so that 87% of it went to the white people, and the rest, these little spots all over the place called the homelands, which were originally called the Bantustans. And that was for black people. So if you were living in Soweto, for example, you were not a South African. Okay, you belonged to the homeland, whichever was your background. If you were Tswana speaking, you belonged to Popota Tswana. Mm. So you're living in Soweto, and you were born there, but you were not South African. So the plan was, you know, the original plan was no black South Africans. So if you were living there, you could only stay there if you were working for a white business or a white person. As soon as you lost your job, you had to go back to a place that you've never been to in your life, which is now home, and you have to find a place to live there. So those are the kind of things that people don't know, and the extent of this was just incredible. So the more I learned about it, the more I read about it, the more passionate I became about social justice, and that's why I write a lot.
Oftentimes, Ian, yeah. I'm sure you're aware of this, but ask any black person in corporate,
yeah,
South Africa, and they'll tell you that you need to be twice as good before you are on correct. The same level as the lowest performing white counterpart.
Yes.
Right? So, and the response you often get from Business South Africa is, we don't see color, Andile. You know, apartheid ended in the 90s.
Yeah.
We got to move on. You know, we're colorblind, you know. It's all about merit here. You challenge that.
I challenge that strongly. So what happens is, you know, I call it your book of rules. Your book of rules is all your paradigms and all the things that you've learned over the years and you're sitting in your mind. So your book of rules for white people in this country, I often hear people say, I'm not a racist. I don't see color. I treat everybody the same. Which sounds okay. You know, that doesn't sound bad. It sounds like there's no harm intended. It seems all reasonable. However, for a black person listening to that, they say, what do you mean you don't see color? I mean, my whole life has been determined by my color. And you're telling me you don't even see it? I think this is more a problem with your eyesight than with your mind.
I mean, you don't see me.
Yeah, you don't see me. And more importantly, you're saying that I treat everybody the same. But how can you treat me the same? Because you're disrespecting my life experience. I'm not the same as you. You want to make me the same as you. That's called assimilation. Okay, you want to make me the same as you, but in actual fact, I'm very, very different. So please don't treat me the same as you would like to be treated, because you're coming from your book of rules, and my book of rules is very different. And unfortunately, what happens in the workplace is we want to assimilate people. We want them to become more like us. And the other day, one of my clients, I was there working in them, and there was about 25 leaders in the group, and they were all white. There wasn't one black person in the top 25 of this company. And I said to them, and I was a bit upset, so I got a bit facetious, and I said, where are the black people? Like, was there a transport problem or something?
Is there a taxi strike?
A taxi strike. So they said, no, it's not this. So I said, well, why don't you employ any black people in the senior sort of levels of your business?
Yeah.
And believe it or not, the guy said to me, because I can't find any that think like me.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah.
Because they must think like
I was so shocked. I didn't know what to say. I just said to sorry to hear that.
Sir, boss. You might as well have said, sorry to hear that, boss.
So the whole thing about assimilation, when we employ people, it's amazing. You know, you hear human resource guys come out of an interview and they say, we must employ that one. He speaks English so well.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he can speak just like us.
You speak Andile.
He will fit in. He will fit in here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. Okay, because he looks a little bit like us. He sounds like my kids do, more or less, you know. They speak English more or less the same.
But isn't that human? You know, other people will argue, yeah, and I hear you and all of that, but isn't that a human thing that I want to surround myself with people like me, especially in an entrepreneurial business or a family-owned business. I mean, it's my company.
But then you must just employ those people that are just like you, not the others from the other groups, because they're never going to fit into that, and they're never going to be comfortable, and they're never going to be able to deliver the service and feel that sense of belonging, because all they're trying to do is to transform themselves into you. So if you want to kind of survive, say, in business, and I've spoken to a few people that have said, the first thing that I did as a black person coming into this company, I really worked on my accent.
Wow. People say that?
I worked on my accent, yeah. Because I was uncomfortable with the accent. And I mean, people, you could see, were trying to hear what I was saying, and that it was very embarrassing for me. So I said, but you must own your accent. It's your accent. You know, you don't have to change to be like someone else. You must be who you are and what you are, and that's how it must be. So these are the things that we deal with all the time in business.
What is the link, though? Because I often hear, talking to business people, Ian, that there isn't much of an appreciation between, to use your new word that you've taught us today, between cultureneering and the profitability of the business. Right. In other words, if I am that family, I've just painted the picture.
Yeah.
And I believe that everybody that works here should be like me.
Yeah.
What's the downside of me not having that diversity and therefore having to learn to cultureneer? Because it feels very comfortable for me that I have everybody that looks like me, talks like me, likes the same sports as me. It's very nice. Like, I'm happy.
Yeah.
I don't see the reason. I don't see the commercial reason why I should venture into this world that Ian first telling me about.
Okay, right. I mean, I think the first thing to think about there, Andile, is the country. What is going to happen to the country if we do not bring people into the business that are different to us? And look at the unemployment in South Africa. 70% of the youth are unemployed in this country. Okay, and about 40% of the general population is unemployed. So how are we going to create a country where everybody has an equal access to the economy, that everyone has a chance to, you know, to create a sustainable lifestyle, if we don't bring these people and redress the imbalances of our past? That's the key, because we've just got this massive inequality gap that we've had for many years, and it's just getting worse at the moment. So the only way we can try and redress that is to bring people through the organization, people of color that haven't had the advantages in the past, and to try and create some sort of equity, you know, going forward. So the problem is that particularly young white people will say to me, oh, this is not fair, you know, this is reverse racism. Okay, because now I wasn't there. Don't blame me for the sins of my fathers. Yeah. I'm all cool, you know, And it's
I've got black friends.
And it's not my fault.
Yeah.
And I know two black people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I know two, and I'm working on a third.
I'm working on a third. Sounds like a recruitment drive.
So the thing about that is, you know, if you're not sort of able to try and redress it, so I would say to people that say to me it's reverse racism, I'd say it's not reverse racism at all. In fact, all we're trying to do is to redress the past. Okay? We're trying to recreate some sort of balance. And it means that white people, and unfortunately young white people, who are perhaps also kind of the victims a little bit in this thing, but they need to understand that despite the fact that they were not the perpetrators of what happened in the past, they were most certainly the beneficiaries. And that is the key. They were the beneficiaries of the system, so that they have the opportunity, and they've had the schooling, and they've had the education, and they had everything that they've needed.
But yeah, my dad worked really hard. He built his own business,
correct,
and you know, with his own sweat, blood, and tears.
Yes.
Apartheid didn't give him anything. How am I a beneficiary?
But he did get something. You know, he had the opportunity to build that business. Okay. And if you look back at 1953, which was the year that I was born, which I'm ashamed to say,
was a long time ago.
Hendrik Verwoerd stood up in Parliament and said that we're going to create a new Bantu Education Act.
Yep.
And he said that black people will never rise above the level of laborer, and therefore there is no need to teach them maths and science.
Yeah.
So they took maths and science out of the school curriculum, and they didn't have that for the next 45 years. So that effectively eliminated black people from the economy, because how do you compete if you don't have an education? So they took black people out of the system completely and said, you will be laborers from now until whenever, and we will control the economy. Thank you very much. So that's hectic stuff.
That is.
And if we don't redress that, then what are we doing? We're just going to perpetuate the status quo, and the gap is going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I can promise you we're going to see a lot more looting, a lot more unrest, because people are eventually going to get hut full of having nothing, having an opportunity.
Absolutely. You use through the book, you talk about many experiences in your life.
Yes.
We only have 3 minutes left before the Q&A, but I have to ask you to tell the story of the red discs and the blue discs.
So the red discs and the blue discs was a little exercise that we did in our workshops. In those days, we called them diversity workshops, because we didn't have the courage to call them race relations workshops. So we called them diversity, which are a lot softer. You know, diversity is nice because it just kind of teaches you little differences in culture and stuff. Didn't get into the heart of it. But so there was this particular exercise that we came across, and I developed something. It was called the red-blue exercise. So we had about, say, 25 people in the group, mixed race, mixed levels of the organization, and I would go around and I would hand them out a choice of a red disc or a blue disc. I'd do this. And they'd choose one and they'd pin it on. And then when they were finished, I would say, right, all the red people on the one side, all the blue people on the other side. So I started by separating them. Then I gave them a little psychological test, a very simple little thing. They had to answer about 12 questions, but they didn't know that the points were jippoed. Okay? So no matter what the red guys answered, they were going to come out low. Okay? They added up their own points, but the points were different on the one sheet compared to the other sheet. The blue people all worked great. They came up with fantastic scores. And then I put up a slide that said, there's a Professor Cameron who comes from the University of California who's been doing studies on the colors that people choose. and what he did was, he came up with this thing, and I put up a slide, and it says that blue people who choose blue, are clever, they're patient, they're tolerant, they have good brain capacity, and it was just a beautiful selection of all the positives in the world.
Right.
Red people are up to shit. They got nothing. They moan and they groan, they complain, they're always arguing, they're argumentative, and et cetera, et cetera. So then I say, but okay, so let's look at the scores. And red people come out with much lower scores. And I said, you see? Look.
It's true.
It's true. So immediately they get completely freaked out. And they start complaining and going off. And I say, but you see, it says there red people are always complaining and arguing. So I was just reinforcing all the time how bad the reds were and how great the blues were. So then I'd give them a little puzzle. Okay, but the one puzzle was very, very simple. The other one was impossible. So I gave a little puzzle to the blues, and they finished it in 2 minutes. No problem. All good. The red, I struggled for half an hour. They couldn't. It was impossible. You couldn't do it. Didn't have a solution. So eventually they give it up, and it's just bullshit.
And then you say.
And I'm saying, you see. So just keep reinforcing and reinforcing all the time, the good guys and the bad guys. Then it comes time for tea. Okay. So I say to them, listen, at tea time, we want the reds to go to that table and the blues to go to that table.
Right.
So as tea comes, they stand up and they turn around. The blue table is like a buffet. It's like a buffet. It's got cakes and teas and biscuits and sweets. The red table's got bugger all, basically. It's got little polystyrene cups with cold tea that's already been poured long time ago. And so they go there, and they're pissed off. Now they want to come and take the food from the blue table. And the blue guys start defending their table. They say, no, this is our table. There's
you must
your
order
table.
Your stuff. Yeah,
go, piss off, you know. And so it goes on and on and on. And eventually, after a long time of this continuous thing, and I nearly got a few claps from some red people, particularly as I was working in the Lonro mining business, which is there, you know, near, what's the place called, Marikana.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had some seriously right-wing people there. And in those days, it was the AWB.
Oh.
I mean, some of them were so far right, you had to send out a search party to find them. It was ridiculous. Anyway, so one of them nearly cut me, but that doesn't matter. That's a different story. So then, after all of this, I say to them, okay, guys, I just want to tell you this is a hoax.
Wow.
It's been a hoax. And we've been going for about 3 hours now of continuous reinforcement.
And the reds really believe they're inferior. And the blues really believe they're superior.
The blues were so comfortable in their superiority. And even you would find that, you know, that somebody who had a mate in the red side would say, I always knew this about you. You know, I mean, this is what we did. And eventually I said, listen, this was a big hoax. And the red people were very angry, very angry. And the blue people also a bit angry because now they had this fantastic feeling and that all just kind of got deflated. And then I said to them, you know, if I was able to create an element of superiority and inferiority in this room in 3 hours, just imagine what has happened in the last 300 years. That was the message.
Wow.
And some people still to this day, someone will pass me in the street and say, I don't remember your name, but I remember that bloody red-blue exercise.
Brilliant stuff, brilliant stuff. A round of applause, ladies and gentlemen, for Ian Firth, author of Cultureneering, Culture, Diversity, and Customer Service. To let you have a sneak peek, there are 13 chapters that go all the way from setting the socio-political context, as he said. It gives us a really, really good history of our country and why it matters. Then it goes through the different pillars just before going through the purpose and values, the reason to being. And then I like the last part, which is that Cry for Hope chapter where he really shares his own views about where we're going as a country. And I also liked the case study that he shares. There's some work that he's done in a real company with real people. And in fact, all of the stories are amazing in that they are actual real people. Ah, is the CEO of that company here? Okay. Thank you, Lance. Thank you for coming. We might have questions for you, Lance. That was a very interesting case study. All right. It is my job now to open the floor. If you don't mind just removing your mask and sharing. I think there is a microphone. There we go. And he's got a sanitizer in the one hand. The man is very prepared. He's ready to be COVID compliant. All right, I'm going to go for hands. There's the lady right here. Thank you very much. And I can see your book is marked. You got little sticky notes. Man, this is like an exam. I'm glad I'm not Ian. Ian, good luck, buddy. This lady is organized.
She's going to start testing me if I remember this thing.
I'm sorry to disappoint, but I don't have a question.
I'm
Tulofelo.
Hello, Tulofelo.
I'm Tulofelo Mjadona. So I just would like to express gratitude to you, Ian, for writing this book. You signed my book, and I told you that I read your first book, got the feeling, because I do my hair at Candy & Co, and they just had it, and I started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. I think I slept at 2 a.m. that day.
Yeah.
So when I saw a tweet that you were launching this book, I had to get to Exclusive Books. Unfortunately, I haven't come to the end of the book. I'm on page 60.
No rush.
And it's a great book, so this is how it looks. And it's
so that's just the
pages.
First 60 pages?
That's just the first 60. Imagine what it's going to look like at the end.
I thank God that in my journey of leadership, I came across this book that taught me that it's okay to be a black female in corporate South Africa, and I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, and I belong, and I have my own uniqueness to bring to corporate South Africa. And I also learned so much. I love history, so the sections that talk to history, I enjoyed them so much. I didn't know that I wasn't actually born in South Africa. I was born in Buputatwana. So from Tulofelo, from Mabopane, I am so grateful that through the vulnerability that you showed in writing this book. Talking about race is not an easy thing. We constantly walk around eggshells because we are afraid to acknowledge that someone is black and someone is white. And there's a difference in how they experience corporate South Africa as a black person and as a white person. I will forever be eternally grateful that you wrote a book that taught me that Tulofelo from Mabopane can actually grow up to be an exceptional leader who touches people in a very positive way wherever she goes.
Wow, Tulofelo, that's wonderful.
Thank you so much, Tulofelo. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Tulofelo. That was a very emotional start to the evening. Some of us are shedding tears here. Can I get any points? Anybody on the left, on the right? Don't be shy. There's a gentleman right at the back there. Oh, there we go. Some blessings from the skies. Are you still sanitizing? Ah, I see.
Yeah, no, he put a...
Well done.
Hi, can you hear me? Oh, there we
go. Loud and clear.
Okay. My name's Jeff. I'm Ian's cousin. Just something that resonates with this, it's not directly with entrepreneurship, it's with sports, and I'd like you guys, your opinion on it. Years ago, I was lecturing in sports management and in coaching and training, and one of the subjects that we had was on captaincy. We're talking about the ideal captain.
Yeah.
And two names came up at the time. The one was Hansie Cronier, the other one was Neil Tovey.
Wow.
And then one of my students put up his hand. A chap by the name of Pitso Mosimane. You might have come across him at some stage.
Well, only the most successful coach ever. But
anyway,
hey.
So Pitso says, no, I don't agree with Neil at all. And so I said, fine, well, why not? So he says, well, because he's white. So there were like boo hisses all around the room from black and white alike. So I said, no, hang on, let's just hear Pitso's opinion on this. What is the problem? So he said, now, Neil can't understand my problems. I can't tell him about what I have to face when I go home, which is going to reflect on my performance on the field, which I think you guys have discussed in a way. And it clearly wasn't a general consensus, but it was just a Pitso thing. Well, there's my thing. Was it a Pitso thing, or in your opinion, is it a wider-ranging issue?
Great question, Jeff.
Okay, good question. So... So I think it's more than just a pizza thing. I think this is the type of thing that happens all the time in South Africa, is that people are having experiences in their life outside of sport or outside of work, and other people are not recognizing what that is and therefore not taking into account that this person needs to be treated slightly differently because they haven't had the same experiences that you've had. So we can't treat everybody the same. Mm-hmm. Sameness is not the answer in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's recognizing the diversity and understanding the strength that each person has and the uniqueness of each person to be able to contribute to the whole and to create a sense of belonging in the organization. Mm.
And I guess to attach to Jeff's question, though, is I'm sure Tula Fellow will agree with this experience, is that it's very interesting that in corporate South Africa, just because your leader or your boss is black, it also doesn't follow that because you're black, they'll support you, right? Mm. So very often, the black experience can also be a bit complex in that you think, well, there you go, I've got Mr. Tlatshwayo as my boss. Clearly, I mean, surely, then he starts behaving in a certain way. And that's back to your point about bowing to the boss.
Yeah.
You know, at times, exactly. Black people do get that point where they are the captain. But they still may have paradigms that Ian talks about in here that robs them of their full ability to be a representative boss, black or white. If you've got the paradigms, you've got the paradigms. And one of those paradigms could be fear, perhaps. Maybe you just think, maybe there's some things I can't do. You know, I'm lucky just to get this job. What's Tulu Fellow talking about the promotion? You know, maybe she should just wait. You should wait your turn, Tulu Fellow. Even though I'm black. Anywho,
absolutely.
Great point. Thanks very much for that, Jeff. Shall we take a couple more? And then we'll... Thank you, sir. Gentleman right here.
Hi, my name is Musi Woody Whitehead. I've got two questions. Hi, Andy. Two questions for you, Ian. First, maybe something about your formative years. Did you grow up in a family of entrepreneurs or, just when you were growing up? And then you mentioned the impending unemployment crisis. How do you think that will be solved? I mean, do you have an opinion on how you think jobs will be created? What sort of businesses will create those jobs, in your opinion? Because I think that relates to your book. There may not be a problem with having... Musi Woody's business, where he employs batho ba gagwe. If I'm only employing 10 people, and if we all employ 10 people and they're all my family members, I may not need to change my business.
Gotcha.
But if you're talking about scalable businesses, maybe then, diversity and multiculturalism is important. So, so that's related to that second question.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Okay, so the first question is, yes, I was part of an entrepreneurial family. My father was one of the founding directors of Russell Furnishes, and he was, interestingly enough, the guy who introduced Joshua Dorr to South Africa. So I had a father in the furniture business. Joshua Dorr. Yeah, so that was my dad. My older brother is sitting right over here. Lawrence, welcome all the way from Australia. He's also an entrepreneur. And my other brother Rodney and my brother-in-law sitting over there, Toby, he's also an entrepreneur. So we come from a very big entrepreneurial family. So that's the answer to that question. And the other one is about employment.
Yeah.
So there are two elements of this. The one is the big corporates, okay? And I was really disappointed to see that some of the big corporates were laying off people during the COVID time. And that really didn't make any sense to me because, if you don't have the money, obviously, and you're undercapitalized and you're a small business, then you do have to lay off. You just can't, you have to survive. But big companies who had the resources to see people through and keep them employed during that time, rather than just adding on to the huge pile of unemployed people out there, was just adding to the misery of this country. And I don't understand that at all. I think, they should have rather just kept them employed. And yes, and they would have made a bit less money, and the shareholders maybe would have grown a little bit. But it really, we need to look way past our narrow financial objectives now. We need to build the country, and we can't keep laying people off. Okay, so that's the one thing. The other thing is, I think employment will come a lot from entrepreneurship. So the small businesses that you're talking about are going to be great. And the more that we have of those, the better. So people are going to have to become entrepreneurs because they're not all going to be able to be employed in the formal sector. And that's where we hope that employment will start improving. And so those young people who feel that they are being excluded because they're white, let them go out and start new businesses and employ people and uplift the country. Because every one of us in this country has a moral obligation to uplift the people of this country. We cannot continue as it is. The status quo cannot be sustained. So we have to do something to uplift people and to recreate the employment that's going to give us some sort of future in the country.
Absolutely. And just to add to that, thank you, yes, round of applause. Just to add to that, Musi, I do also think that there's nothing wrong. In fact, if anything, it probably should be encouraged. Those small businesses of 10 people where you employ one bagin. For me, that's where it starts, because those same relatives of yours would, if you don't create the business and employ them, they would typically go and join the unemployment queue. So you're solving the problem, absolutely. And if it starts as a family business, there's absolutely no reason to feel guilty about that. And to attach the culture-nearing issue, that's hence the question earlier to Ian about why, how do you link the culture to the business? For me, the culture-nearing question isn't about whether or not I've got family members and therefore I can just kind of impose the way we do things. For me, it's linked to the business performance. You talk about this in your book. You talk about when you got into the beauty industry, how everybody told you that, customers want to be treated by people of the same race, right? So you was rewriting about the fact that you said, somebody told you all the white ladies want white therapists. Yes. And you went, why? Surely if somebody's trained, they can do the work, they can do the work.
Sure.
And you saw that experience firsthand.
Yes. And that's one of the things that I'm probably most proud of in terms of my working life, is that we were able at Sorbet to literally change the face and the color of the beauty industry.
Wow. All right. One more to go. Going once. Going twice. All right, we're going to wrap it there, ladies and gents. Over to you.
Okay, so I would just like to offer some thanks, please. Okay, firstly, to Exclusive Books. Thank you so much for hosting us here this evening. It's fantastic. Really appreciate that. I want to thank Pan McMillan. I see Terry. I don't know if she's still here. Terry?
Somewhere at the back.
Okay. Terry's the CEO of Pan McMillan, the publishing company that has published the book. Thank you so much to you and Andrea and the rest of the team and Eileen and the people that are here and Veronica. I also want to thank my own team at Hatch, and my son Brent, who's standing there in the red checked shirt, who has been our business development manager and has really helped develop our business tremendously. Leanne over there, who's our coach and has been helping me tremendously. Thank you very much. And then two other people, Kerry Simpson, who's standing there. Can you stand up quickly, Kerry? Kerry is our PR lady. We've been working with her for 18 months, and tonight was the first time I met her.
Wow.
So that's COVID for you.
Where's the brother who was worried about buying the BMW?
Okay, he's not here. That's Rodney. He's the Lion Park man.
Ah.
Okay, yeah. Unfortunately, he lives out in Hartbeespoort.
You got to read the book to read the story.
And then also, I want to thank Nadine Todd over there, please.
Right.
Who was a very important and critical part of writing this book. Thank you so much, Nadine. Absolutely amazing. Right, and to everyone else, thanks for coming out again tonight. Really appreciate it. Nice to see you all. I can't offer you any alcohol, unfortunately, but there's some juice there. We'll have some juice.
Thank you, ladies and gents.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Next Brave Conversation. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating or review. To catch all the latest from us, you can follow us on all social media platforms at Brave Group SA. Thanks again, and we'll see you again next time.